Hey, this is Cedric Youngelman, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. In this rip with Preston Pysh, the fearless cadet, we speak about his lessons from West Point Academy and how FinCEN may be violating your rights. Thank you to our sponsors, River and Thea, for helping to power this show and deliver you this content for free. And I just want to give this quick shout out to our affiliate, the Florida Beef Initiative, Bitcoin Bay, Rancher Leonard Horak, Texas Slim, and Roughshot June. The Bitcoin Matrix is proud to partner with Circle 6 Ranch, the Florida Beef Initiative, and Bitcoin Bay to offer you a taste of Black Angus beef that's grass-fed, antibiotic-free, and steeped in tradition. My family loves these guys and their beef. It's great to support local Bitcoiners and businesses that are on a mission to fix the money and fix the food. It was great to shake my rancher's hand, Leonard Horak from Circle 6 Farms, who works closely with Roughshot June and Texas Slim. These dudes scream integrity, and each one of them is a badass by default. Discover their premium beef selections like the Florida Pasture Beef Box and join a movement that's restoring Florida's local economy one steak at a time. The Florida Beef Initiative, Circle 6 Ranch, Bitcoin Bay, and the Bitcoin Matrix Podcast. Energy secured with exceptional flavor and a better way to eat. Go to FloridaBeefInitiative.com/discount/matrix to buy your beef direct from Circle 6 Ranch, where the richness of Florida's ranching heritage meets the unstoppable force of Bitcoin. Pay with Bitcoin and invest in community with every succulent bite. Link for a discount can also be found in the show notes. River is the Bitcoin exchange of choice for the long-term investor, the best place to stack sats and build your Bitcoin wealth. I've been using River for over 3 years now because they are a Bitcoin-only company that has earned my trust through their proof of work. Securely buy Bitcoin at the tightest spreads in the industry. Have peace of mind thanks to their 100% full reserve cold storage custody and enjoy zero fees on recurring orders. River built and owns their own infrastructure. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. If you need help getting started or have questions, River has US-based phone support for all clients. Use my referral link in the show notes to get started and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin. Your Bitcoin deserves the best protection. With Thea, you're in charge. No more fears of losing your keys or falling prey to hackers. Their self-custody multi-sig vaults empowers you to be the ultimate guardian of your Bitcoin. Share the power of secure Bitcoin with your loved ones like I have. Thea is my favorite multi-sig solution because Thea enables shared custody, making it a family-friendly choice for safeguarding your digital legacy. And for those unexpected moments, Thea's got your back. Their multi-device vaults with both assisted and sovereign recovery options means your Bitcoin is safe, always accessible, and ready for the future. Thea is more than an app. It's your partner in the Bitcoin journey with 24/7 support from a team that cares. Download Thea now using the link in the show notes and get your first 6 months free and experience the new standard in Bitcoin multi-sig security. At the Bitcoin Advisor, I am here to help you get your Bitcoin off your exchange, simplify the process, address your Bitcoin challenges, and ensure you feel confident every step of the way. I can help you set up your multi-sig and secure your Bitcoin for decades to come while ensuring you can sleep at night with the right estate planning and asset protection strategies to make sure your Bitcoin is safe for you and your family. If you or someone you know needs help buying Bitcoin and creating a multi-sig vault, I'm here to help. Head over to thebitcoinadvisor.com/Cedric. thebitcoinadvisor.com/CEDRIC now and put some time on my calendar. The link to set up time to talk with me can also be found in the show notes. If you don't know or think you have your Bitcoin on lockdown, call me. The time to act is now. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Preston Pysh.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Preston Pysh is a well-known financial analyst, author, and podcast host, particularly recognized for his insights on value investing, leadership, and Bitcoin. He co-founded the Investors Podcast Network, which hosts several finance and investment-related podcasts. Through his podcasts, Preston has interviewed numerous financial experts, business leaders, and thinkers, providing listeners with a deep understanding of various investment topics. He's the founder of BuffettsBooks.com, and his videos on financial investing have been viewed by millions of people around the world. He takes great pleasure in taking complex ideas and making them accessible. Preston graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point with a Bachelor's of Science in Aerospace Engineering. Preston also graduated from Johns Hopkins Carey Business School in Baltimore with a Master's of Business Administration, Banking, and Finance. He has authored and co-authored a number of investment and autobiographical works. Preston also wrote multiple finance and investing-related articles for Forbes from 2016 to 2018. Preston has a big interest in Bitcoin. He's also the founder of investment company The Pylon Holding Company, and he enjoys spending time with his wonderful family. Preston Pysh, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Hey, Cedric, how you doing? Nice to record this with you.
Yeah, well, it's nice to see you again. We got to meet in South Carolina.
Yeah.
At a very interesting and special event.
Yes.
That was the launch of Ocean.
Yeah.
And for me, quite a learning experience, besides just being a remarkably engaging experience. What did you make of that event?
I was excited to go to a hydro dam and see, you know, the hydro being immediately turned into Bitcoin right there on the spot. It was pretty fascinating to kind of see the operation firsthand. You have a deep appreciation for, I can't remember how much hash rate being conducted there. It was, do you remember the number?
I think close to 1 megawatt if they were at full production. And I think they could have gone further if they had more machines. They were actually wouldn't be at peak.
Yeah, you're right. So just seeing that and then comparing it to the amount of global hash rate and then just seeing the sheer power of the dam and the water kind of flowing through, it was very humbling to say the least. You get a deep appreciation for how much energy is being plowed into this thing on a secondly basis.
Yeah, it was kind of amazing how close we got to all of that.
Kind of
an insurance agent's nightmare, I would think. But quite visceral. Yeah. And what did you think of the content, or, you know, did you know a lot about maybe the issues in mining and mining pools and specifically?
I didn't. And attending that event and then obviously having a conversation with Bitcoin Mechanic and many others during and after that event really kind of opened my eyes to just an idea that I had never really thought about, which is all these people are supplying hardware and hashing to these pools, but they're not putting forth the block template. And you would think that it would be proportional to whatever hash rate an individual or a corporation or whoever, whatever that size of hash rate that they're providing, you would think would be proportional to the vote of which transactions get included if their hardware finds the block. And that's obviously not the case. Because the pools are putting forth the templates that they think is best for the pool. And, you know, I think there's another, I don't know if it's a counter argument, but another important point that if you start putting that power in the hands of the individual miners, as far as like this amount of hash rate gives you this much potential, if you find a block that you can put forth whatever block template. It's also important to talk kind of the other side of that, which is, let's say you and I are participating in a pool and I just totally fall on my face with the block template that I'm putting forth as far as the fees that are associated. Let's say I don't put any transactions into the block that I find, and there was more than enough time for me to put forth a reasonable block template that had fees associated with it. You get caught up in that lack of fees that are put in that block if my hardware finds it and we're participating in the same pool. So there's a little bit of a, what's the right answer as far as like a minimum threshold of like fees that are incorporated into the template for a pool when you're putting this power into the hands of every single person providing hash rate. So I think that I love this. This is what I love about the ocean piece is they've definitely started a conversation that is desperately needed in this space. I've talked to people that are participating on the ocean pool and they're participating in other pools. And they have told me that they make more money on the ocean pool. And I know that that's going to trigger a lot of people hearing me say, I'm just telling you, I'm just reporting what one person told me. This is one person. And they do participate in multiple pools. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of ambiguity as to like, how are those, like what is actually being received by the pool versus what they're paying out to their participants. And this is why I love Bitcoin, right? This is why I love Bitcoin, because you can come in here and for a pool that's producing less than 1% of the global hash rate, they sure are making a lot of noise, which is typically an indicator that there's some type of signal taking place and something that people should maybe pay attention to and ask more questions about. And I think that that's exactly what they're doing. And if for whatever reason they aren't, you know, bringing more more earnings to people providing hash rate through their pool, then they're going to fail, right? It's that simple. And that's why I love Bitcoin and I love this space. So I think it's a wonderful thing to be talking about and thinking about, and particularly on the block template construction being pushed down to people providing the actual hash rate.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating. I mean, it brought a really fascinating conversation online about mining and how decentralized or centralized it is, what hashers are actually doing with their hardware, what's going on with ordinals and fees. And there's a lot of different ways we could kind of talk about that. But one of the questions I want to ask you is, how do you think that impacts someone who's like a traditional value investor or, you know, just wants to invest in Bitcoin and is trying to understand the value proposition here? And maybe they've looked at, you know, the seven monetary network effects of money, and they're looking at different things, and this is a new thing that they're hearing about. Maybe they don't understand all the angles here. How much of this should be a signal that they should receive and digest and kind of put into their thought about how to value Bitcoin?
Yeah, so this is a question that I hear a lot coming from my background with value investing. And it really, it challenges anybody who's deeply an equity-only type investor, or they could even be a fixed income person and kind of comparing it to contrasting what returns they think they're going to get. And they're looking at this thing and they're saying, well, okay, so today it's at 39,000. How do I know whether that's a deal or not, right? Like, how in the world do I value this thing? And that's completely, as far as I'm concerned, that's completely understandable, because they're looking at it and they're just like, is it worth 60,000? Is it worth 10,000? I don't know. I don't know right. What's going to drive it there or higher or lower. So like, it seems like such a gamble for me. So I'm just going to stay away from it. And for this person, I think you bring up a fabulous point, which is you have to understand network effects. You have to really kind of dive into, well, what has allowed Bitcoin to have a floor historically? Like what drives that floor? Because when we look at Bitcoin's price in log terms, there's something that is very strange kind of playing out from a price action kind of standpoint. And it's something you cannot ignore. As soon as you put the chart in the log terms and you see it, and you're like, what is going on? This doesn't look like any equity I've ever valued in my life. So like, why are we seeing these floors? Why are we seeing kind of a ceiling on these tops as it's kind of playing out? And the best way I can maybe describe like what's playing out here is Bitcoin is in an adoption cycle of better money. People moving away from fiat and choosing to store their retained earnings or their savings in this new monetary network. It's been playing out for more than a decade and it seems to not be slowing down. So how do I value that? How do I look at it? And what I would say is you first have to deeply understand a cycle of speculators to investors, long-term holders. Mm. And when you understand that, once the supply of issued coins gets very tight, where investors and long-term holders are dominating the market share of the coins outstanding, the Bitcoin outstanding, that's what's laying the floor of the price. And so think about some of the basis for some of these people. So some of these people bought Bitcoin at $5 a coin. Some of these people bought Bitcoin at $500 a coin. And when they see the price go from, call it 70,000, which was the last high, and it drops to 16,000, and their basis on, call it 1,000 coins is $200, they're not sellers. They're not sellers. In fact, they're just looking at this as yet another speculative cycle that burst, and then it's long-term holders that know, that deeply understand like what's happening on the engineering side of this. They're not selling because they know they're looking at the competitor to Bitcoin, which is fiat money. And they know that they have to continue to expand that to the tune of trillions of dollars on an annualized basis. And so they're looking at that and they're saying, this is a long-term hold for me. My basis allows me to handle this volatility. I'm a long-term buyer. When these speculators fall out of the market, I'm buying more. And what drives the next, it's completely cyclical. So now we're getting ready for the next 2 years that the floor has been set by long-term holders. The influx of speculators are showing up. They're showing up because now we have even more vehicles, call it an ETF, that they can just go into whatever trading account they got. They can smash buy and they can play the speculative game. And then along that path to wherever this takes us next is solidifying and bringing in more long-term investors. Now, not all of them stay. But it seems the price chart to me almost seems like it's heavily tied to human nature itself. What I mean by that is you are going to attract some people that intellectually deeply try to understand what it is that they own through that abrupt price action that maybe just showed up for the speculative trade. And through that process, learn that what they own is something far more superior than a speculative trade. And they start to understand the inherent nature of the system that it's competing against. And whether that's 10%, 20%, I don't know. But I do know that 70% of the coins aren't moving when we look at the on-chain. And I don't know if that gets a little bit harder to understand with the ETF in this next cycle. Maybe it is. But to date, it's been a pretty good signal for a price floor when you have 70% of coins that haven't moved in a year, that investors are dominating the speculators, and that's what causes the price to run. So these are ideas that I think anybody who's an investor understands supply demand, and they understand liquidity, and they understand how the price action is actually moving on a very small margin of the overall supply. They understand all these dynamics, but when you start heavily involving yourself in Bitcoin, these are the things that are going to really drive your ability to understand where you think a decent price is. And I would say today, like, I think that a decent price, like a very decent price for Bitcoin, is anywhere between $30,000 and $40,000 to $50,000 in the coming 4 years, based on what I suspect the price action and the speculators that are, getting sucked in at this moment are going to take it to. So does that mean it's going to happen? No, it doesn't. But I think I guess my bet is human nature is going to continue to persist. There's no change in human nature since Bitcoin's inception, and the economic backdrop of the amount of fiat that's going to have to be added into the system in the coming 4 years is completely in keeping with what we've seen in the past decade. And because of those two things, I think Bitcoin's a buy. And this gets far removed from well, what's the PE on company XYZ? How much earnings are they producing? What's it currently priced at? What's their competitive moat? Things like that. Now, speaking of competitive moat, so people would say, well, how do you compare Bitcoin to some of these other blockchains? And I think that when we're talking about that, I think it comes down to this Bitcoin trilemma, where decentralization and security are optimized in Bitcoin, and scalability has been pushed to the second or third layer. And you can only optimize for two of the three at the base layer. And Bitcoin's the only one that's optimized for decentralization and security. And therefore, I think that it's the concrete that you can actually build all these additional financial rails on top of, where the other protocols, call it Tron, Ethereum, you name it, they have optimized for scalability at layer one, which means they haven't optimized for security. That's kind of a big one. And decentralization, which is also a really big one if you're going to not have governments involved. So, yeah, if I was going to try to talk like a competitive moat that Bitcoin has over the other protocols, that's it.
Sure. No, fantastic points. And I like what you mentioned there about concrete and permanence, because I think what's building on Bitcoin is permanent, sort of like Manhattan is permanent. But we also mentioned, you mentioned human nature, and I can't help think about price volatility and whether you think it will go up or down into the future. Mm-hmm. Is this sort of an inflection point where things like the Bitcoin ETFs reduce volatility going forward, or do we see increased volatility for some reason?
Percentage-wise, I think that's the only way you can really address it, is percentage-wise, maybe it's getting a slightly less volatile into these cycles, but I don't think too much. I think that for the most part, like on this incoming cycle, it wouldn't, this isn't a price prediction, but I'm speaking to the volatility that we may see. Like, it wouldn't surprise me in the least bit if we went to 400,000 in this incoming cycle, or 500, somewhere in that range. So when we're talking about like volatility, people are looking at the price today and it's 40,000. That's a 10x move in potentially the coming 2 years. So is that less volatile than previous cycles? Yes. Is it significantly less? Not really. It's pretty dang volatile. If you know what I'm describing would play out, that's a lot of volatility, especially in the face of, call it, the S&P 500 that might have 20% annualized volatility. I would characterize it as that. I see each of these cycles just being a fractal of previous cycles.
Right.
So yeah, I don't think that you're going to see much reduction in the volatility. I think it's going to still be ripping strong for the most part.
Right. What do you think? I'd love to switch a little bit to your background, switch gears. I mean, I'm going through the diary of a West Point cadet right now, and I'm in the scene with the cutting the cake and the Kool-Aid.
And okay.
So, and it's kind of hard to maybe separate or make these things distinct, but what do you think you got out of your military background or combat experience that helped you as an investor?
The first word that comes to mind is discipline. You become very disciplined through something like this. So from like a stock investing standpoint, it's very easy to let your emotions control you. And I think that people need to know how to manage that and have the discipline to manage their emotions. And I mean, you go to a military academy, if you're an emotional person and, wear your emotions on your sleeve, let me tell you, it's going to be a painful, painful experience. And so whether you show up with all of that whether you're able to endure 4 years and be an emotional actor, I don't think you'll make it all 4 years if you haven't learned a little bit of discipline and being able to control yourself. And so I think that those are something that have helped me tremendously in financial markets, especially in Bitcoin in particular, because of that volatility. So you have to be able to zoom out. I like to say that you have to match your position size with your intellectual knowledge of what it is that you know about the thing that you own. Because when people don't, they'll often buy the top and they'll often sell the bottom, which is a double whammy. You've made two mistakes in that scenario. The deal, like, you're going to get the most questions after this thing runs for the next year to 2 years. All the people are going to be knocking on your door. Hey, tell me about this Bitcoin thing, which, may or may not be, but most likely is probably some of the worst timing that you can have the interest for. And so when you don't inherently understand what it is that you own, why you're buying it, where you're at in a larger cycle of, because everything on the planet revolves around cycles and frequencies and the magnitude of the frequencies. And if you aren't well-versed on some of those ideas and why things are moving the way they are, like, you're just you're setting yourself up for a lot of pain. And, you know, some of those lessons and some of that, discipline is what I would say I learned at the academy. I mean, plenty of other things. Knowledge is obviously very important, right? Like that's something that's just crammed down your throat at the academy. Is the only way that you can navigate your environment and accomplish whatever it is you're trying to accomplish is by learning from other people's mistakes and, you know, learning your environment. That's what books represent effectively, right? Is just this deep knowledge of your environment so that you can craft it and engineer a solution to the problems that you face while trying to navigate your environment. It's really quite that simple. So I would like to think that the school is also definitely pushing this thirst for knowledge, intellectual knowledge.
Yeah, the scene about, I brought up the cutting the cake, and you could probably tell the story better than I could, but you know, each thing that happens at a meal has to be introduced correctly by the, and you were calling them plebes. This is back then.
Yes. And you said it correctly, by the way.
I've listened to the person reading the book because I know there's that discussion. And around cutting the cake, so, you know, the older officers are constantly trying to make things harder for the younger officers and just in terms of delivering the way things have to be. And so they have to cut the cake into 5 slices usually. And there's the game around, you know, getting people to back in or out of the cake so that people don't have to cut it down into that way. And this is just getting into sort of standard operating procedures and sort of incrementally getting to a better place. Mm-hmm. And not just kind of, you know, being just getting it done and however we're going to get it done. And there was a really good quote in there that made me think a lot about Bitcoin, though, that you quote Thomas Edison, "We shall have no better conditions in the future if we are satisfied with all those which we have at present."
Yeah.
And I think about, you know, and so sort of that grind at the table of them giving you a hard time and you guys having to do things over and over and figure it out and make the mistakes and with the condiment caps and everything. It makes me think of just the 4-year cycle and how long that can be for people, especially, you know, Bitcoin more often goes sideways or down. It's a very few days that it screams up and where all the net positive volatility is captured. And it's, I think, of time in the market, not timing the market. But another topic that I can't help but think about is just, and I know you enjoy Alex Gladstein's work and some of it's about the petrodollar.
Yeah.
And so with your experiences as just an investor, and the American, you know, economy being fiat denominated based and your background, I mean, what has your kind of evolution been on, you know, sort of our army fighting for the petrodollar and our, you know, what are we fighting for? And, you know, and I want to get into FinCEN and freedom at home, but, you know, just kind of want to ask you about the petrodollar, I guess.
So it's really easy to sit here today with an option to opt out of a really poorly constructed system and point at it and say that system is really bad and horrible and all the people that stood it up are just horrible human beings. That's where I think a lot of people that are in Bitcoin are pointing back at that system and that's what they're saying. And I'm not trying to defend anything here. I'm just trying to add a little bit of balance to such a black and white point of view. If we didn't have Bitcoin, if Bitcoin wasn't discovered, if Satoshi wasn't the person that he was by writing this white paper and walking away and not doing a rug pull like all these other people that show up to blockchain technology, right? You wouldn't even have an option out of this fiat. Like we would be looking at a very, very dark period for humanity if Bitcoin didn't exist. So let's start there. Let's also just look at the 80 years, let's call it, of progress that humanity has had with, you know, there's definitely been wars. I experienced one and the hell that is. Defending that dollar system. And this is why I'm such a hardcore Bitcoiner, because I went through such an experience. And when I look at that, like what better system did you have? Well, you would have to rely on human beings to manage the gold standard and not debase against it, right? There's plenty of examples throughout history where a gold standard had lasted hundreds of years before human nature got the best of these cultures, right? I would argue that in America, that didn't last too long. It, like, they came off the gold standard pretty dang quick, right? We went on the gold standard, you know, in the 40s, and by the 70s, we were off of it. And I would argue we were already debasing that ledger, destroying that peg well before we came off of it. You could maybe even make the argument the entire time we were on it, it was being destroyed. So when we look at the pain and then the evolution into the petrodollar system, I think you have to go back to the 40s, 50s, and 60s and look at the string pullers back then and say, these are the people responsible for the failure that the country had by manipulating that money multiplier off of the gold standard way back then. And then the petrodollar system was just a jump or a sidestep to keep all of that stability together that is now finally eroding itself. So, like, we can look at the petrodollar system and say, that's it. That's the, I think you got to go even further back than that. And I think that when we went through the Bretton Woods system, it was very clear that the U.S. was pegged to gold, and then everybody else's fiat was pegged to the dollar. And so we were all in this boat together globally coming out of Bretton Woods. And whoever breaks that peg to gold through that, like, I'm sorry, they're kind of responsible for the pain and suffering that will eventually manifest itself from such poor and selfish decision-making. So I think that's kind of where the root of a lot of the pain that the world is experiencing today actually is it's coming from. So regardless, you know, right, like we can point and say this person's the responsible party or whatever. The point, though, is we have a solution to this. The solution is very clear. Thank God the solution doesn't rely on humans, trusting a human at this point. The technology and the mathematics have presented itself for the entire planet to not have to trust one another to exchange energy. And boy, oh boy, what an innovation and how exciting. And that's why I'm here, man. That's there's nothing more exciting on the planet happening, as far as I'm concerned, than this technology.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. It is the most exciting. I mean, I have a whole show about it. You switched gears, and I hope to get to that in a second. So where did the investing come along from? And specifically, maybe the focus on Warren Buffett. I mean, I think you've written the Warren Buffett Accounting Book, Reading Financial Statements for Value Investing, and Warren Buffett's three favorite books, A Guide to the Intelligent Investor, Security Analysis, and The Wealth of Nations. So when did that all come into play, and specifically Warren?
I've always liked math, and which is why I did engineering for my undergrad. And, you know, when I was a pilot, it was kind of like, all right, well, like, what am I going to do with my free time? And I was really intrigued by this idea that maybe I can figure out what I think a company is worth. And if it contrasts with what it's trading for in the open markets, then I can make money by outsmarting the valuations that the public markets think. Right. And so that was the interest. And then it was like, okay, well, if that's the interest, who does this better than anybody on the planet? And Warren Buffett was the guy that, you know, was, you know, there. So, like, why would I go take a course from Joe Schmo off the internet when I can learn literally from the number one person on the planet that's done this? And so I looked at what books did this guy read? Who were the people that influenced him? What has he personally said? And so I read all of his shareholder letters, obviously, and many other things that he's written through the years, in concert with like any book that he's ever recommended or studied, and the people that he admired, just so that I could try to wrap my head around, like, how does this guy do it? Because obviously he knows what he's doing. The scorecard says so. So that's where I, I went down that rabbit hole and just really enjoyed the process, really enjoyed like the economic calculation behind trying to figure it out. And then, and through that experience, I realized very quickly that, so much of this was rigged. And I say that because a lot of these IRR calculations and things like that, like I'm looking at it and I'm saying, there's no way we can, in coming out of the 2008 crisis, it was like, there's no way they can just flood this system with a bunch of freshly printed money, extract bonds out of the market and put, you know, freshly printed money into the hands of these people that were holding these bonds. That's a manipulate, like at my core, I was like, that's a manipulated market. So like that's not fair. And that's not a free and open market, which means everything could be potentially mispriced. And so then it was like, well, how is inflation being calculated? How are they doing this without the prices like just blowing out? Which then kept me going down this rabbit hole of the question I kept asking myself from like, I would say the 2008 crisis to probably 2015. The question I kept asking myself is, everybody's doing this from a nation state standpoint. There's no peg. So how in the world does this global manipulation resolve itself? I mean, I would literally every day would go by and I'd be like, how does this resolve itself? There's no way that this resolves itself in a good way, right? Like I like to think that I'm an observer of nature and humanity. And like anytime somebody manipulates something in a selfish way for themselves, it will always backfire in some type of way, right? And so I'm looking at this really large wave that's flooding the globe with respect to this QE that's being done by everybody. I'm saying, this is going to resolve itself somehow, and it's going to be really ugly for the people that are the string pullers of this legacy system. And so, lo and behold, 2015, Bitcoin kind of enters my life. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, this might be it. This might be how this resolves itself. And I wasn't completely sure, but the more I studied it and the more that I dug into how it was providing a technological peg to fiat, like I just knew right then and there, it was like, this is how this is going to resolve itself.
Right. So backing up a little bit, how did you go from West Point and serve in the military to starting TIP? How'd you get into podcasting?
Well, it was me educating myself really kind of through the process. And it was, you know, you always try to look for win-wins, if you will. So like, if I'm educating myself, sometimes the best way to educate yourself is to teach somebody. And, so some of it was just that it was, I was by no shape of the imagination an expert in any of this stuff. And I would argue I'm still not. It was just like, hey, the best way to learn is to learn alongside the student. And this is when YouTube was just kind of really becoming a thing. Podcasting was definitely becoming a thing. I think I'm at it now 10 years. So we were very early on the podcasting front. And it was just me trying to figure things out. And if I looked like a fool, so be it. Like, I just don't really care necessarily about that. And I'm sure there's been many conversations where the listener has said, oh, this guy sounds like an idiot. I've always been fine with that. That's not something I really, really care about. I'm more interested in discovering the truth alongside the audience and alongside the people that I'm interviewing. And that's always been kind of the driving factor. And evidently it resonated at some level with people listening, and we just kept doing it, and it was a lot of fun. And, you know, you don't work a day in your life if you're enjoying what you're doing. And that's probably the best way I could just describe the podcast or YouTube or any of it. It was just us having fun, really.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. What was it like? Because I thought it seemed like a big inflection to me when Preston Pish of, you know, TIP was going to do Bitcoin focused podcasts from then on. Mm-hmm. And before then, there was, you know, probably even before I was interested in Bitcoin, I would go to TIP for macro and for finance and just, mm-hmm. you know, kind of the broader stuff. Mm-hmm. And then to hear Preston talking about it was kind of like, oh, cool, this has reached that kind of platform. Mm-hmm. And then to see you go and take your own show and focus completely, because even before you switched over to Bitcoin Focus, there would be a Bitcoin Focus show every once in a while from Preston.
Yeah.
And what was that like, maybe internally and even externally?
I was going back to kind of how I described finding Bitcoin in 2015. I was desperately trying to figure out how all of this debauchery was going to resolve itself. And when I found Bitcoin in 2015, I was like, wow, I think this is it. And then as I went through that cycle, which the timing of finding it in 2015 was very serendipitous as far as it being a low, like it was around 200, 220, whenever I really kind of came across it and immediately bought it. I was just like, yes, I can't afford to not have some type of position or exposure to this if this is what I think it can do. And everything that I could see from an engineering standpoint was it's going to provide a global peg and the governments can't shut it down. As I went through that 2017 cycle, which ran to 20,000, I'm watching the amount of speculators, you know, when it's being brought up by random people off the street, like the legacy financial flags and alarm bells were going off in my head, like, this isn't sustainable. This is pure speculation at this high. And the other thing that was going off in my head was nobody on Wall Street is taking this serious. And if this is truly going to be a meltdown in fixed income kind of flowing into Bitcoin and nobody on Wall Street's talking about it, well, then we're about to go through a massive speculative sell-off because this thing's at its extremes. So I sold my position in that period of time in December of 2017. And you can see it in my Twitter timeline. People can go back and look there and see what I was saying back then. But I sold my position, with the full intention in that moment that this thing is going to come back and it's going to come back like really strong. And going back to this idea of cycles and just kind of understanding everything operates inside of a cycle. You just have to understand the frequency and the magnitudes, and you can kind of really harness that as opposed to being a victim of it. And so I watched Bitcoin from the sidelines, even though I was covering traditional finance material on the show. I watched Bitcoin vigorously through that sell-off in that period to try to see where I thought the speculators were washed out and that the long-term investors were setting the floor, kind of like what I described earlier in the show. And when the 2020 halving was coming up, we would do a quarterly mastermind discussion on the show. And I recommended Bitcoin. It was probably 7,000 back at this time, somewhere in that range. And the next quarterly mastermind was coming up, and I was just like, I can't unsee what I'm seeing here. And I think that this incoming cycle is going to really open the eyes of people in traditional finance. And I think this is something that actually has to be covered every single week. And since making that decision, I mean, Bitcoin's at 40,000, so it's done pretty well over a 4-year period. And I think I see today actually being very akin to that decision in 2020, in that the coming 2 years are going to be gangbusters in Bitcoin. I think it's going to do extraordinarily well. The 2 years after that, I don't know. We'll see what happens with the macro backdrop, but I think this coming 2 years is very akin to that 2020 to 2021 into maybe 2022 period of time.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have the same outlook, but I want to think adversarially, especially for this conversation, yeah. Especially with your background and the articles you've recently written. So one of the articles you've written was Bitcoin is anti-totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. But I want to kind of buttress that up with your most recent piece, how FinCEN may be violating your rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your military background, we were talking a little earlier, we fought for the right to have this discovery in our world now, in the sense of we have this freedom and we want to have the ability to have Bitcoin as an escape hatch. So I want to talk about FinCEN, because maybe there are attacks out there that we can't foresee. Maybe the next 2 years won't be gangbusters. Maybe it's the third and fourth year. Maybe it's the fifth year. I have no idea. I think Bitcoin will continue to always do what it's doing from an engineering perspective. And it seems I like to be an optimist because I think it's just you live a little better life. But I tend to be a little bit cynical and contrarian. So I just want to get into FinCEN, though, because I don't know if this is as understood as maybe or as talked about. What is this? What is this proposal? It's called 2023, I think 0016A.
Yeah. So you're not going to build a new system without the people living in that legacy system, the ones that have dominated the legacy system, to put up a fight. It's just, again, human nature. So when we look at that fight, I would argue that this FinCEN proposal put forth by Elizabeth Warren and many of the banks that back Elizabeth Warren, even though she acts like she's literally the polar opposite of that, that this is their fight, really. They're trying to frame this as something that is money laundering and dangerous to the United States. And but anybody who's looking at this objectively and just kind of like seeing what's happening, they clearly know that if you're going to launder money, you don't do it on a public ledger of any sizable amount of money, because they have to go back to an exchange and convert it into fiat if they're going to participate in the legacy system. And it's completely auditable by anybody, right? As opposed to, and this is the irony for me, is like literally as like she was publishing this proposal through FinCEN, the month before, I want to say, you know, the U.S. is putting literally pallets of cash onto military aircraft and flying it into Iran, billions of dollars, right? So they've got to fight this, right? The legacy string pullers, the ones that have benefited from the old legacy system, they're going to fight this, and this is their approach, is to paint Bitcoin and paint crypto as being evil and being used for illicit things. And so they put forth this proposal, this FinCEN proposal, which is the financial crimes proposal. And they have to allow for a comment period before it's enacted. This falls under the president to basically say, yep, it's approved. And if this is a breach of the Constitution, well, then you can fight that in with the legal system, is how this is going to, and this is going to get approved. Like, make no mistake about it. This is going to get approved. They're going to put it out there. And then everybody that's in crypto is going to battle this with their lawyers. And then there's going to be all these issues that the legal system is going to find with the FinCEN approval. And hopefully this document that you're referring to that was published, and hopefully we can get a link in your show notes for Ego Death. Yeah, there you go. To this for your listeners. It's too late. The comment period had ended. I think it was on the 22nd of January that the comment period ended. But I published this about a month and a half before that comment period ended, and we got hundreds and hundreds of comments added into the register, into the Federal Register. And the whole intent of this was to highlight with case law all of the breaches that this proposal had with the Constitution. So it addressed the unreasonable searches and seizures. It talked to the freedom of speech and association and all the breaches there and all the case law that it addressed. It addressed the right to financial privacy and how it breached the Constitution in that respect, how it breached due process rights. It talked about how your right to secure your personal information was breached, and the right to non-discrimination was also heavily addressed through case law, and then just access to financial services and how it breached the Constitution in that regard. So I laid it all out. It was 60 pages long of information just to kind of go line by line of like all the breaches. And what I'm really trying to accomplish is I'm trying to arm future lawyers that are battling this in the court system, call it 2 years from now, 3 years from now, that they can go back and they say, look right here in the Federal Register, look at all these comments that address this particular breach of the Constitution. And yet they still passed it as is and just ignored all these comments that the public was telling them that they breached. That's what I was going after with publishing this document, is giving them future ammunition to fire in the court system to protect our rights as citizens, right? Like, and this is really important. It does not matter whether the United States figures this out or not for Bitcoin. Bitcoin is going to win on a global stage, whether people in the US like it or not. Of course, I wouldn't spend time writing this thing if I didn't want the United States to understand this and win. I'm using air quotes, win, and allow citizens to harness this technology as opposed to fight it. It's like, it's the equivalent of trying to stop night from coming outside. Like, anybody fighting Bitcoin is there like trying to prevent the sunset from happening, right? Or the sunrise, whatever side of the pole you want to take. So, you know, I am a champion of, let's harness the incoming technology as opposed to acting through fear and being scared of it. And, you know, going back to your earlier comment, sorry to go on and on, but to your earlier comment about my time at West Point, the one thing I did learn at West Point was never, ever accept defeat. Never, ever allow your environment to dictate that you're going to fail, right? And so many of these actions that are being made by these legacy string pullers, they are actions of fear. They are scared to death of this thing, as opposed to just looking at it and saying, hold on a second, there's a massive opportunity here if we decide to harness it, right? It's just, it's hilarious. It's so pathetic, really. Like, don't be a victim of your environment. Harness your environment, right? Win. So I don't know. I guess it's a little bit of a pet peeve for me.
I can understand it completely. And, you know, this isn't about, like you said, Bitcoin will be fine with or without this. It's just,
yeah.
But what I want to get at here is about, you know, the impact, I guess, on American citizens. So, I mean, this piece really gets into how it can impact your freedom of speech, expression, anonymity, privacy, and association. All these things are constitutional liberties. But is this getting at mixing the ability to run your own node to self-custody? Is that what this is really getting at? If I would kind of bring it back to that jargon and that level?
I think so. I think that that's really the core of what they're going after. But even that is a failure on their part, right? You can, so go after mixing. What they have to realize is they've had a luxury over the past, you know, the legacy system allowed them to peer into everything that happened by anybody, anywhere. Everybody's all up in arms about the CBDC. And, like, I hate to tell you, but like, the legacy system already knows every single transaction you take. And if they don't like it, they can turn you off immediately, right? So it's already here. Like, this technology has been here for ages, and that's what they're battling. They, in their fear-based mind, they think that if they lose control of that they're going to lose control of the ability to tax and the ability to collect revenues out of citizens, right? But what they're failing to recognize is you can still tax citizens by going to the businesses and putting it on as a sales tax. Now, if you're a legacy string puller and accustomed to the legacy tax ramifications, you like the setup. You like the fact that you can obscure so much of your income away by not paying on these sales taxes and things like that. Think about this. If somebody goes out and buys a $40 million yacht, don't you think that there should be a pretty high tax burden for, you know, such a luxury type purchase? Well, under this new system, that's where it has to move to. That's the only way that you can operate in this new system, is you have to tax the luxury items, right? And you have to tax at the point, because you can't see into the back end rails. So attacking the mixer just tells me they don't understand where the cycle's moving, like the long-term cycle. They don't understand it. And so all they're going to do is just act like the fearful little worm in the corner, and they're gonna write up big, you know, waste everybody's time writing up stuff like this to put into practice, and then stick all the lawyers and then battle them in the courtroom, only for this to naturally move in a direction that you have to move to point of sales for tax implications, right?
Right.
And think about all the wasted energy that was spent battling this, because at their core, they're fearful and scared, as opposed to looking at things from the optic of there's hope. There's something here to provide hope. It's hilarious. It's sad, but like, I guess I understand why, you know, there's a lot to wrap your head around intellectually to understand the cycle and where it's moving. And that's the mistake, is they're not matching their actions with intellectual thought.
Mm-hmm.
They're just matching it with fear.
Sure. And kind of continue on that path, though. What is, I mean, if this would affect running a node, what is the essence of a Bitcoin node and why is it important?
Well, I mean, if you run a node, you're able to conduct an audit. It's just that simple, right? So like, if I gave you a bar of gold and I said, trust me, bro, don't melt that thing down and like actually look at the composition of the matter inside of that bar of gold, that would be the equivalent of me saying you're not allowed to run a node, right? So them coming out and trying to prevent individuals from running full nodes, what they're really championing at its core is saying nobody's allowed to melt down these gold bars, but trust us, they're real. There's not lead inside of them. But you're not allowed to test that. That's what the attack on running a full node is effectively saying.
Right.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
there's no pure intention in that, obviously.
Right. And then would you think there's a greater than non-zero chance of a 6102 type executive order against Bitcoin and, you know, sort of the elimination of self-custody or something along those lines?
This is something that every country on the planet has to contend with, is are your elected officials that govern your country going to rug pull you if you're using some type of turnkey way to get access to the price action of Bitcoin? Okay. So could it happen in the US? Of course it could. Could it happen in Germany? Could it happen in Japan? Could it happen anywhere? You name it. This is a risk for anybody inside of that jurisdiction. Now, one of the advantages I think that this country has is state rights. So like when you look at Wyoming, like they've already passed laws. There were Bitcoiners that lived in that domain that saw this attack vector and already passed state laws to protect against this. Now, can those laws be overturned? Of course, any law can be overturned. It's all just paper and, you know, pen. The challenge for a person who is taking self-custody is like, how in the world can you prove that the person has the keys stored or not, right? Like, good luck. I wish them luck. But for the people that are relying on a simple turnkey solution, call it an ETF, and that there's a custodian that has to comply with state laws or federal laws or whatever, like there's an attack vector there. So, you know, going back to the comment I said earlier, like you have to match your intellectual knowledge with your position size. And that goes to how you're custodying it, right? So everybody's got trade-offs. Everybody's got to account for their own risks. And the thing I love about Bitcoin, going back to my time at the academy, one of the lessons I learned is take self-responsibility for yourself, sir. Nobody's going to put you on their back and carry you 20 miles through the forest. You have to do that yourself. And if your feet are bleeding, so what? Do the hike. Don't be a wimp. Don't be scared. Get busy. Take responsibility for yourself. And Bitcoin is that through and through, man. Like, I'm sorry. Like, if you're truly custodying Bitcoin, it's the big boy program. You lose your keys. Sorry. You just made a donation to everybody. So if you like those kinds of rules that you're actually responsible for everything, well, Bitcoin's the place to be, baby.
I hear you on that.
I am here for it all day long. Let me tell you.
I love it. And I think out of Wyoming, I think you're referring to Caitlin Long and Trace Mayer, both brilliant minds.
Yes.
I'd love to see Trace come back and speak some more. I'd love to talk about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can go from sort of Lawrence Lepard, and maybe you can include myself in this, and we can sound like doomers. And, you know, you can go to Joe Colasari and Mike Alford and say, you know, the economy's pumping, you know, and I don't want to speak for any of these people, but I'm just broad stroking here, using them maybe as examples. And, you know, the markets have never been higher, all-time highs, unemployment's low, the movie theater's packed, the restaurants are packed, people mm-hmm. going on vacation. And you can go to maybe, you know, Dr. Jeff Ross, and he'll say, well, you know, everything's kind of moving along with global liquidity. This is kind of normal volatility. Bitcoin ran up a little bit. Volatility ran up a little bit. Now M2's kind of tapering off. Bitcoin's tapering off. And, you know, we'll see where we go over the next 18, 24 months. And I don't know what your take on the economy is, because I don't know what signals to look at anymore. Some mm-hmm. seem to be blaring, and signals that I would have thought would have meant the end of times every time I saw them. And I just kind of get used to something going off always, and some really good signals in the economy always, and it's mixed messages everywhere. But I do go outside, and it seems kind of normal, regardless of where debt levels are and credit card debt and automobile debt and interest rates. I mean, what is your take?
So to understand my frame of reference on what I think happens next, right? It's really simple. We are going through, in the legacy system, total and utter consolidation, right? Visualize this. Let's say we have a room of 20 people and they're all performing a task. And it's in the 20 people, when they work together and everybody performs that task, collectively as a group, they can perform at their optimal. Okay. Now imagine that there's some type of incentive that's driving this consolidation, that instead of the 20 people doing their small task that is beneficial to the next person, which is then beneficial to the other person to their left and right, right? That as there's some incentive in there that's causing it to not be 20 people tomorrow, it's going to be 18 people tomorrow. And that one other person is picking up the task of the other person, okay? And as you continue to consolidate these 20 people, now there's only 5 people that are performing all of these acts. And at first, this consolidation seems like they're more efficient, okay? And that they're able to produce more collectively through this consolidation. But as that squeeze continues to occur, and you get down to 3 people now doing the task of all 20, right? Things are starting to be dropped. Okay. And the net that you thought was an efficiency gain is actually turning into the detriment. But this is important. The incentive that's driving that consolidation is not easing up as this consolidation is happening. In fact, it's amplifying and it's getting tighter and tighter. And now it's 2 people the next day. And now things are really starting to fall apart. When you would look at, let's say we were putting like a stock price on the value of these individuals, okay, and we were adding them up, okay, and it seemed like there was a really high valuation. If the value of those 3 people that are performing all the tasks now, if the stock value was 10 before, now it's 100 or 1,000 on those 3 individuals. And if we were going to apply an indice to this collective group of 20 people, the indice is going up. In fact, it's melting up. But what's happening to the collective group? It's becoming completely dysfunctional. And so like, that's how I would describe what's happening, not in just the US, but literally globally, is you have this, what appeared to be optimal efficiency. And where I would say that peaked out was right before COVID. And we can see this through the inflation data. And we can see that like the idea that bonds should be priced in negative terms because inflation was becoming deflationary. We were so efficient at producing the widgets around the world that we couldn't, if we added more stimulus, there was no way we could actually manifest inflation anywhere on the planet, right? That was the idea in 2020. And now all of a sudden, everybody's talking about how the world is unwinding and they can't figure out why. And the reason why is because all these manipulative policies further and further and further consolidate everything into the hands of just a few people controlling those strings. And as you do that, you're creating massive disruption in the efficiency of the body to function. Okay. So when I look to the future and I'm saying, I don't see it as doom and gloom and all this other stuff, mostly because I'm a Bitcoiner. Okay. Because Bitcoin is here to catch and reorganize the 17 people in the room that were sitting on their hands and saying, well, there's nothing for me to do at this point. Right. And this is going to take time. This is not a quick, we're talking about a massive wave, and we're talking about a frequency that's very substantial as far as like the size of it. And it's flowing from this legacy system to this new system. And so when I describe the legacy system, yes, we're going to continue to see equity consolidated into the hands of the Googles and the Facebooks and the top seven companies on the planet. When we're looking at the S&P 500 or the Dow or any of these indices, they are going to melt up because the seven companies in the industry are driving everything from a market capitalization standpoint. But what you're not seeing is company 2000 and how it's getting obliterated because it's like a tick on the back of an elephant. So you're not going to see that. When you go outside and you interact with everyday people and they're able to do things, they're in debt up to their eyeballs. They can't afford a house. They literally rent everything and they own nothing because it's all been consolidated into the hands of a really large bank or some tech company. Okay. So what unwinds this and why I'm such a hardcore Bitcoiner is all of this is enabled, as you know, by this fiat money printing press and people thinking that all these debt instruments, this fixed income debt instruments, is valued at what it is. Why do you think a backstop facility was stood up for the last year and it continued to blow out in the usage? It's because every one of these banks' balance sheets were completely impaired and they would have failed immediately if this incentive structure that's forcing consolidation didn't continue to step in with even more force than it had 2 years previously to keep this system propped up to continue to consolidate equity into the hands of the few. The system is desperately trying to resolve itself. And this is one thing I have total faith in. They are going to press even harder moving forward, which further amplifies these forces, which further amplifies the need for Bitcoin. So it's not that I'm not a doomer. I'm just trying to quantify the reality in the way that I see it in cycles. And thank God there's something to actually catch all this buying power and to reorganize the equity and price it at appropriate discount rates. And you know, that reorganization is going to be very beneficial. It's going to bring harmony back to the planet where individuals can actually own things again and not rent seek everything. So it's an exciting time as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, very dynamic. Well, how do you think it plays out in housing then? Is that a melt up as well?
No.
I think housing has a whole other slew of messy issues, and commercial real estate seems like it's crashing. Mm-hmm. No one's just marking to market until they have to sell.
That's right.
And no one's ran to the appraiser yet about their tax bill. That seems like it's coming in a wave.
It most certainly is. But next 2 years in commercial real estate, you're already seeing markdowns from previous prices before 2020 that are 80% discount to what they were, which is the impairment that they have to correct, right? Because the paper that rides on top of that, all the debt that rides on top of these very real things that are drastically impaired to the tune of 80% discounts to the previous prices, that is why there's so much impairment that they have to plug with more fiat. Because if they actually let that become impaired, okay, that's what causes this incredibly deflationary forces in fiat that make the dollar really valuable through that short-term event. But when they plug that hole, they're not plugging it in an efficient way. If it was $80 million that went up in smoke. They have to plug it with $120 million to just get it back to neutral, right? Because of the inefficiency right. of plugging it with more fiat. So, and it may be, the multiple may be way worse than what I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I would argue it probably is way worse than that in reality.
But what about residential? Does it play out in a similar way?
It falls under the same, it falls under the same issue, which is, and this is how you know that the money printer is coming back, is because they cannot let the housing prices fall too far, or everybody understands the shenanigans, right? Everybody's keeping their mouth shut because maybe their house bid by double. You know, if you had a $500,000 house, now it's worth $1 million in some areas over the last 4 years. And the people who owned that and probably only had 20% down when they bought it, they're happy because they just basically made $500,000 on something that they put $100,000 down on, right? Talk about a 5X return in fiat terms. Like that's kind of keeping up with Bitcoin if your principal was only 20%, if you were highly levered. But you'd have to get the timing of the interest rates. And now the interest rates, like you can't sell it to anybody. So you're super illiquid in that house through that. So yeah, you made money, but it's very illiquid. So like all of these dynamics are that old system blowing up. Because where does that go? That consolidation that I'm talking about is like fewer and fewer people can afford to buy a house because they can't afford to borrow at 7% on $1 million house anymore. So like you're seeing that top tier echelon of housing, and then the middle tier is becoming locked up and it's becoming illiquid. Like the whole system, right? That's where we're going.
Wow.
It's going to be ugly. So you're going to see things, I guess the way I would describe it, because this is such a great question and it gets to how nuanced some of this is. Like earlier, I was talking about like high quality equity that retains a competitive moat and how it's going to melt up. Commercial real estate, it's going to get obliterated, absolutely obliterated. They're going to step in with the money printer to try to prop it up, which is going to cause more dislocation. And so depending on what piece of the economy you're talking about, and we can get into whatever nuance take you want, it's all hitting its poles, right? It's all getting tapped out at its limit. And then it's going to have to swing in an opposite polarity in order to remedy itself. And Bitcoin's the thing that's going to make that polarity swing.
Right. Well, do you think the Federal Reserve just announced that the Bank Term Funding Program will cease making new loans on March 11th? Do you think that's a big deal?
I think this announcement's hilarious. So the arb that existed between the overnight rate, that basically banks were able to put money on the take out a loan there and just arb the difference between the overnight rate. And they've kept this open to recapitalize. What they're doing is they're recapitalizing banks by effectively providing yield curve control to the banks. Okay. And so like all this capital, all this fiat printing is just like flowing in and helping out these banks. Well, why did they decide to close that arb window to like now to this March shutdown, which is the 1 year anniversary? The reason why is because they didn't want the facilities, the amount of loans to look like they're blowing out like straight to the close, because then it's obvious that there were shenanigans. Everybody knows there's shenanigans happening, right? But it'd even be more obvious if they let it go right up to the 1 year anniversary. Why are they able to shut it down? Well, they're shutting it down because supposedly inflation's now under control and the rates should be coming down. They're not, right? And they're going to start doing QE, which is them buying bonds and saving these banks and all the impairment on their balance sheet. And they're going to flood the system with more fiat. Bitcoin's going to, that's why I'm bullish on Bitcoin. What a scheme, man. What a scheme. What debauchery. Like anybody like propping up like this, these people that are like, Bitcoin's a religion. And like, no, dude, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Like your fiat, like, faith in this legacy system is the religion, sir. Like, wake up. Good God, wake up.
Well, maybe talking about faith and religion, is UBI going to be a thing in America?
It's
helicopter.
It's going to be. Yeah. And that's not me promoting it.
No, like, I understand.
Yeah. That's just when you think about the impairment that's happening with commercial real estate and all these other areas where you're going to have impairment, they have to add more money into they have to start inserting it into the lowest level, or you're going to literally have social unrest. I think you're already having social unrest. It's just going to be worse. So right. Yeah, they have to do UBI. Once they start doing that at a much bigger magnitude than they did after COVID, that UBI is going to be the thing that really turns the legacy system inside out. Yeah.
Then with the Bitcoin ETF, I think one sort of unforeseen development maybe is with Grayscale and the sell-off in terms of whatever's happening there. I don't know what to make of it. One thing I've been talking about with some friends is the idea of, you know, a lot of everyone's talking about the fees between the different ETFs. And if you're in a, let's say, a tax advantaged account, or you've 5x'd on Grayscale already and you came from at a discount to now not, you know, or whatever your situation was, and you're ready to part with your GBTC, the thought that just going to one of the other ETFs is straight about the fees when they're all going to have spreads on the price. And, you know, you might get an 8% slippage on buying into an ETF versus real Bitcoin and leaving your, maybe your GBTC. So I don't know if everyone's leaving because of the spread. I don't know why GBTC has such faith in holding on to all this liquidity and assets under management at this price point. Or I don't know if there was some, you know, handshake to keep Barry out of jail.
That last one's that's an interesting argument on the last one. If you really think that the system is deeply corrupt, I guess you could even go to that last point. I don't know. But I'll tell you, I think there are so many bad actors in this legacy system that have, you know, they're propping up the legacy system because they've benefited tremendously from it, and just crony capitalism, at, you know, that's, who knows. But if we were just going to look at it mathematically, and you're saying, okay, so like, I think does Kathy have the lowest fee at like 21 bips?
They're battling down there, but I think she might be at the lowest fee. Sure.
Yeah. So if we just say that that's kind of the lower fee and that people can move to, what is that? 5, 6, 7 times less fee than Grayscale. Cause I think they're now at 1.5. So that is significant. That is a significant difference when you compound it. And, you know, I think Grayscale was just thinking, you know, we got people with really low basis in this thing, and they're not going to move out and pay the tax burden to move into one of these other vehicles that are, you know, giving them a 20 bip fee. And you know, we haven't seen the sell pressure subside yet. And I think we should probably hold judgment as to how smart that decision was until we see like what the final sell-off was, because if the fee is 7 times higher, that means they're making 7 times the amount of their competitor. And I think they're also looking at it as that maybe that fee isn't sustainable in the long haul. Maybe some of those fees are going to have to maybe settle in at maybe 60 bips. I really don't know the math on it.
That's what you're saying.
But it's been kind of fun to watch. I mean, I'm sure for people that bought Bitcoin for the first time through an ETF and it's down however many percent that it's down, aren't having a fun time. But what is it down? 20%, 25% since the ETF launch. I totally missed this, by the way. I was not expecting there to be such a mass exodus out of GBTC because of the fee, but you know, Monday morning quarterbacking it, I guess it does make quite a bit of sense that you would see such an exodus. But yeah, I don't have anything too profound on the take.
I wonder if they're Monday morning quarterbacking and thinking, wow, did we miss it? I mean,
yeah.
And where's the reaction from them? Because they could always go, like you were saying, maybe they lower the fee and wait till everyone raises, and then they could raise theirs kind of in kind. Fascinating the way that's playing out. I also don't know if this is like sort of, I've heard about maybe when gold launched, the GLD ETF, that it took a year really for price to move after that. And I'm not even getting into shenanigans in the background, but just maybe, you know, the first year is not gangbusters because of the ETF. I guess the people running the ETFs would know how much demand they had beforehand. But just at a quick glance, it seems like they're sucking up 10,000 Bitcoin a day or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that seems substantial just at that rate.
So many people are speculators. It's one thing that I've learned through the years in doing an investing show is the amount of people that, you know, if I talk to 100 people, I can't tell you how many would be speculators, but it's way higher than, and they would call themselves investors, but their actions say they're just hardcore speculators. They come up with a very superficial narrative. They buy something on that. And if the price goes with them, they just continue to plow into it and then they'll sell it. And they're not buying things. You know, Buffett would say a punch card of only 20 punches for all the things you own for your whole life. Right. So you got that on one extreme, which I would call like deep investing, looking at a business as if you owned it operationally. You're not going to run it. If you have a profitable business, you're not going to run and sell it here and buy it there and sell it again and like all that type of stuff. So, but I think most people are very speculative. So once we do get some type of floor from this ETF and the investors and the long-term holders continue to stack it, you're going to get some price action, and then it sucks in speculators like no other. And it's even easier for the speculators to come to the market now. They don't have to go open a Coinbase account. They can just go to the, you know, trading account they've already got and smash buy.
Yeah. I think the large amount of speculation in society is just driven by fiat nihilism, which leads to just gambling. And
totally.
People feel like they just don't have enough to buy real good things that they could invest in.
That's right.
So they're either going to consume or gamble and hope to really out punch everybody. Rather than just stay even, because if you lose a little bit, you stay even. If you win a little bit, you stay even. And I think it's just driven by nihilism. But I want to so you bring up Buffett. What do you think of his track record since say 1995 or 1998 or 2002? Just in terms of like, let's say, you know, the modern tech era of you know, investing in NASDAQ and his track record there.
So okay, I got a chart in front of me. I have the S&P 500. I have Berkshire Hathaway here. So what was the first date you had?
1995.
I'll tell you exactly what it is.
So I was thinking like, you know, when AOL was really starting to penetrate the marketplace, Windows 95, I think, came out.
Yeah. Okay. So here we go. 1995-ish. Berkshire Hathaway has outperformed the S&P 500. His return since 1995 is 1,761%, and the S&P 500 was 914. So practically doubled the S&P 500 since 1995.
And where do you think that would put him against other maybe hedge fund managers? If we were
when you look at hedge funds, 98% underperform the basic S&P 500 index. So I would say he obliterated hedge funds since 95. Now, the performance in the last 10 years might be, you want me to?
Yeah, let's 10 years? Yeah, you cherry pick the, you know, you see, let's go with the last 10 years.
For me, it's very, that question can provoke a very qualitative response, right? But for me, it's just, I guess I'm very quantitative in how I analyze it. So like, we're looking at it from 95, he's obliterated everybody. When we look at, let's go back to 2004, it'd be fun. Let's look at the bottom of the 2009, just to kind of, I think that's a really key, because you've just had, I look at the bottom of 2009 as being kind of this, a new, what's the word I'm looking for, Cedric? Monetary system is being heavily manipulated. So how did you perform during that period of time? So from the bottom of 2009, Berkshire Hathaway has done 640%. The S&P 500 has done 425%. So that's some pretty decent performance if you're just talking from an equity kind of standpoint. And obviously Bitcoiners listening, but well, how about against Bitcoin? I think you guys know the answer.
Well, do you ever see, do you want him to take a turn on Bitcoin one day, come around to it with that?
Oh, wow. I would say that I think a guy like Buffett looks at Bitcoin as being just currency, or if he's just dead wrong about Bitcoin, if he owns a company that actually has a competitive moat and generates free cash flows, that Bitcoin will be used as the settlement layer or used as the unit of account inside those companies, and he's still going to have
Bitcoin.
Now, what he's not, what you're not addressing in that argument, right, is when I look at investment, when I look at performance of my stored buying power, I compare it to anything. Like him and Charlie were on record of like, we don't look at industries. Like I'm in the energy space and I did 7% and the rest of the energy sector did 5%. So my 2% outperformance means I'm a great manager. They would bag on people for thinking like this and saying, it's just returns. Like if I can go get 30% returns in tech versus the 7% in the energy sector, well, that was stupid of me to be in the energy sector. I should have been in tech. So I could use that same line of thinking and that same line of logic of it should be measured of just your sheer buying power. Have you enhanced your buying power? So like, what was his opportunity cost to forego Bitcoin because of this argument that I just want to own free cash flow generating equity when your returns could be double if he just had 2% position size of Bitcoin and the rest was 98% equity. He would have doubled the performance of the S. Well, he would have doubled the performance of Berkshire Hathaway.
Yep.
Approximately, yeah.
What do you think of Charlie Munger? Do you think he should get a little bit more recognition, like be as known maybe as Buffett or what kind of operator? How inside would you compare the two?
Inside of that community, inside the value investing community, I would say the community looks at those two on par with each other. Outside of the community, yeah, Buffett gets all the recognition. But inside the community, I would say that they're literally at parity as far as their how they're viewed optically from their intellectual horsepower.
Do you think there was a synergy between them that wouldn't have been?
I think so. I think, they both just read like maniacs. And I think that they just really respected each other immensely. And I think they had a lot of fun together, I guess, is probably how I would describe those two. And Bitcoiners don't like them because they speak bad of Bitcoin and, you know, whatever. I don't look at any of it through that lens. I learned a ton from both of those two gentlemen. So I'm very thankful for what they imparted on me just through their writing and you know, books that they recommended and whatnot through the years.
Yeah, sure. I grew up looking up to Warren Buffett a little bit. Are you ever going to write another book?
Nope.
Fair enough.
It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Writing isn't my favorite thing to do, really. Yeah, I'm really excited about Ego Death and doing venture capital in this particular space. I think there's just a lot of opportunities on layer two. So that's where my time is between the podcast and talking to really interesting people and doing VC. That's pretty much where my time from a work standpoint is spent.
It seems like you're spending a little time or having fun on Noster or Noster. Yeah. I never say it right.
Yeah. I think that when you look at going back to this theme of total consolidation, it only makes sense that the legacy string pullers are going to try to control through order, even speech. And so when I look at Noster, I think that there's going to be a natural tailwind and an environmental tailwind that's helping propel it forward. And I think some of the success on Noster is going to depend on how manipulative the legacy string pullers get to try to prop up the legacy system. If it gets out of hand, then I think Noster is going to become a critical piece of the infrastructure for communication. I think it's a very important thing to focus on. And I think it's an additional thing that I'm really passionate about. It was just free speech. Like if you don't like free speech, it's because you're trying to control somebody else. It's that simple.
We could say, you know, Bitcoin's this far along in 15 years. How far along would you say Noster is in its short infancy? And is it ready for prime time if that moment came?
I think that it that one's really hard for me to project because I just don't know where why this is hard is you could have a couple string pullers of the legacy system join you, right? And depending on who they are and at what moment in time they decide to join you, this could take a very different trajectory. And the pace of all of this could take a different trajectory. People will think that, well, I've got to convince my mom and dad to use Bitcoin or else it's not going to be successful. And that's true to a certain extent. But where this really starts to take off is when you have a manager of a $10 billion bond tranche that says, I have to have Bitcoin inserted into this to protect the buying power of that bond tranche. And not just him, but his 10 closest friends that also manage $10 billion in bond tranches. That person or those couple people have so much more influence than I think the world realizes in moving this new system forward. So some of it comes down to that with respect to Noster, right? Because if that starts to unravel the legacy system faster, well, then you're going to have this less of a push to try to control the speech. But if they double down on the legacy system, then maybe it's more aggressive. So I just don't really know where that lies. But I know one thing, the incentive structure is there for it to potentially take off if they get a little stupid with trying to double down on the old system.
Well, things keep getting stupider and stupider. So maybe I'm going to speculate on Noster. Not that you can invest or speculate on Noster, but... So my final question for you, Preston, is if you could orange pill anyone in the world, who would it be and why?
I've been asked this before. I know years ago I said Ray Dalio. I don't really care too much anymore. I think Ray's, boy, that last autobiography that came out, what was it called? I read this thing in like 3 days. It was terrible.
So I guess it's Jamie Dimon you'd go with next? Teach him about Satoshi.
No, I wouldn't. I want somebody to get it that has like that level of influence, but that actually is coming installed with a lot of humility and that are here to usher in a much more efficient and something that's going to help the most amount of people. Right. When I look at some of these actors of the legacy system, some of them are deeply parasitic and I don't know them personally, but the little bit that I can see, they seem very deeply parasitic. Like Jamie Dimon being Epstein's banker and like all this other stuff that you read about him, like that's the last guy I want to figure out Bitcoin. Like the fact that if he could never figure out Bitcoin, it might not be a bad thing. So whoever it is, it'd be somebody that's deeply influential and then also comes predisposed with this, humility and desire to help out humanity as much as possible for as many people as possible. Somebody that views the world through like the Alex Gladstein lens of like what he's writing about over in Africa and like how this can help out a lot of people, but that has the influence of call it a Jamie Dimon or the buying power at his disposal of a Jamie Dimon. So whoever that is, I don't know who it is, but I would rather describe the characteristics than the individual person.
Sure. No, I get that. And I kind of like that answer because I don't think it's about any one person. Isn't JP Morgan like an AP in the whole BTF scheme? Aren't they providing liquidity? And he's probably isn't making a few points or basis points somewhere along that chain. So he's selling it out the front and, we're selling out the back and arguing it out the front, whatever you want to call it. But, Preston, this has been so dope. I really appreciate you coming on the show. I'll leave it to you for any parting words and to let people know where they can find you and your work. And I'll definitely place links in the show notes.
I would just say this, Cedric. We are at such an exciting time in history. And to be here, like sitting in this seat right now and here for it is just super humbling, super exciting. Like we have so much to look forward to because we can birth such a better system that benefits everybody and not just the few. And I just don't know how anything could be more exciting than that. And the impact on humanity that humanity's never had this opportunity before because what we've discovered through Satoshi for real, like, I mean, this is just insane what this offers humanity. And, I tell people we've been dealt the royal flush and you're playing the game. Do not act like you've been dealt like a pair of twos, right? Like a person who's running around in a very fear-based way is is the equivalent of somebody playing a poker hand as if they were dealt like a two and a three. And the fact of the matter is we've been dealt the royal flush. So get out there and like, and act like it. Like, don't be acting in such a fear-based way. So it's been an honor, pleasure to chat with you. And I'm just very excited about these coming 10 years. And I just think that it's a massive opportunity for us to make the world a better place and to engineer a better place.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Hey, that's a wrap on today's episode of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast with Preston Pysh. I hope that you found it as enjoyable and informative as I did. Hit us up. We'd love to hear your feedback. I want to thank you for tuning in. Finally, if you could write a 5-star review for the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, wherever you listen to your pods, that would really help get the word out and help new listeners to find the show. As always, keep building, keep stacking, and stay laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.